Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the May 3rd, 2019 issue of the Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows President Trump and Robert Mueller in the foreground. Looks like they're on the White House lawn. Robert Mueller has just pulled a cape, a kingly cape, off of President Trump, leaving him nude, except that there are these rectangles in front of him, I guess that symbolize the redactions from the Mueller report. One says grand jury, one says personal privacy, one says harm to ongoing matter, and they're covering some of President Trump's private parts. The title is Exposed, What Mueller's Report Actually Reveals. And I think that's the number of several, or the topic of several articles, but we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Mueller's findings, Royal Washington, what happened? A defiant President Trump this week dug in for an all-out political battle after a redacted version of Special Counsel Robert Mueller's report was released to the public, revealing the dramatic scope of Russian election interference and the president's furious attempts to derail the investigation. Mueller's 448-page report unequivocally states that the Russian government believed it would benefit from a Trump presidency and conducted a major effort to help his candidacy, including by hacking the personal email account of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager. The Trump campaign was aware of Russia's support, Mueller found, and expected it would benefit electorally from information stolen and released through Russian efforts. Mueller documented more than 100 contacts between Trump's associates and Russians during the campaign and after. Nevertheless, Mueller concluded that there was insufficient evidence to charge Trump or his associates with a criminal conspiracy, citing a lack of proof of an express or implicit agreement with the Russians. Mueller outlined at least 10 attempts by Trump to interfere with the investigation, including twice ordering White House counsel Donna McGahn II to fire Mueller, which he refused to do. Trump also pressured then-Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who had earlier recused himself, to take back control of the investigation. Trump's lawyers refused to let Mueller's team question him in person, and in responding to written questions, the president said some version of, "I do not recall," more than 30 times. Mueller ultimately decided not to charge the president with obstruction, citing a thicket of legal obstacles, including Justice Department guidelines saying a sitting president can't be indicted. But he explicitly refused to exonerate Trump on obstruction, inviting Congress to use its constitutional authority for addressing presidential misconduct. He also suggested Trump could be prosecuted on the findings after he leaves office. Trump raged against the report's depiction of a deceitful and dysfunctional White House and vowed to resist Democratic attempts to further probe the report's findings. "This has been litigated for the last 2 years," Trump said. "I say it's enough." What the editorial said. So much for complete and total exoneration, said the New York Times. Mueller said he found substantial evidence that Trump obstructed justice on numerous occasions, but his hands were tied. Unable to indict a sitting president, Mueller decided it would be unfair to accuse Trump of crimes without giving him the chance to defend himself in a trial. So he invited Congress to pick up where he left off. Mueller also suggested Trump could face charges after he leaves the White House and made 14 referrals for further investigation by federal prosecutors, a dozen of which remain secret. There's still a long way to go before it can be said that justice has been done. Yes, Mueller uncovered some Trumpian excesses and lies, said the Wall Street Journal. But on the issue that started all this, Russian collusion, the president has been telling the truth. Mueller's relentless investigators looked everywhere they could to find a crime they could hang on Trump and his associates for their dealings with Russia. None of it stuck. Yes, the president behaved in typical Trumpian fashion in his rage over being investigated for a crime he didn't commit. But despite some dumb and self-defeating actions, Trump did not obstruct justice because there was no underlying crime to cover up. What the columnist said, Trump not only tried to obstruct Mueller's investigation, it looks like he succeeded, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com. All through the investigation, the president acted like a mob boss with the power to hand get-out-of-jail-free cards to his lieutenants. Trump's political hatchet man, Roger Stone, who was in touch with the Russian court, cut out WikiLeaks, and still faces trial, refused to cooperate with Mueller. So did Paul Manafort, who passed campaign polling data on to Russian asset Konstantin Kalimnik for reasons we still don't know. Trump beat the rap, but Mueller found that he was anything but innocent. Russia bitter enders will never be satisfied, said Ben Dominic in TheFederalist.com. They've gone from Russia stole the election with Trump to Trump spoke about trying to undermine the investigation that was being used to smear him every day for 2 years. In the end, not a single American was charged with conspiring with Russia to steal the election. Sadly, instead of putting the issue to bed once and for all, Mueller kicked the obstruction matter to Congress, guaranteeing at least 2 more years of endless Russia psychodrama. Trump may not have colluded with the Russians, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com, but it's now undeniable that he knew about Russian interference, welcomed it as a gift, and then tried to stop it from being investigated. Rather than defend the rule of law, Trump subverted it. Even the most generous reading of Mueller's report is a profoundly damning portrait of the President of the United States. And our controversy of the week on the same topic. After Mueller, should Democrats impeach Trump? What more do we need to know, said Andrew Sullivan in New York Magazine. Last week's long-awaited report from Special Counsel Robert Mueller laid out an unprecedented series of assaults on the rule of law by our sitting president, leaving congressional Democrats no choice but to impeach Trump now. Yes, Mueller's report debunks the fanciful notion of Trump being a Russian asset. But in painstaking and horrifying detail, Mueller also documents how Trump welcomed Russian interference in the 2016 election, then abused his power to try to thwart the investigation of that attack. In a textbook case of obstruction of justice, Trump dictated false statements, told aides to lie, and dangled pardons in an attempt to silence witnesses. Since a sitting president cannot be indicted, Mueller reasoned, he was forwarding his findings to Congress, which he said has constitutional processes for addressing presidential misconduct. That means impeachment. Until now, I thought impeachment talk was dangerous, said Lawrence Tribe in USA Today. But Congress must heed Mueller's investigation. The founders designed the impeachment process for precisely this scenario, a lawless president using his power to undermine our democracy. The time has come. You know what? Go ahead, said Tiana Lowe in WashingtonExaminer.com. If Democrats are dumb enough to impeach Trump for process crimes like obstruction, they'll pay the same price Republicans did in 1998. Trump, like Bill Clinton, will emerge more popular than ever, and voters will punish Democrats for putting the nation through a prolonged, divisive impeachment circus. There's also no chance of impeachment succeeding, said Karen Tumulty in the Washington Post, given that removing Trump would require 67 votes in the GOP-controlled Senate. The House should hold hearings on Mueller's findings and consider a formal censure. But with engaged voters already turning their attention to the 2020 election, why would Democrats waste time and energy on a process that will achieve nothing but further inflaming the president's political base? The real danger is that if Democrats do not seize and define this moment, Trump surely will, said Eugene Robinson, also in the Post. Unless he's impeached, an emboldened Trump will surely go on the offensive, using the compliant Attorney General William Barr to spin the Mueller investigation as a failed coup and wreak vengeance on his deep state enemies. Impeachment isn't about punishing Trump for his past crimes, said Eric Levitz in nymag.com. It's the only tool the founders gave us to halt the rampage of a serial offender in the Oval Office. If Democrats fail to fulfill their constitutional obligation to use that tool, they will reveal themselves as just another one of our republic's failing institutions. But if the goal is to remove Trump, said Ezra Klein in Vox.com, shouldn't Democrats choose the strategy most likely to succeed? Clearly, that's an election victory in 2020. Impeachment would plunge the country into an all-out partisan war, and moderates and independents might see Democrats as pursuing a doomed vendetta. Besides, why should Democrats do Republicans the favor of removing Trump from office, said Joe Lockhart in the New York Times. Trump is 3 years into destroying what we know as the Republican Party, betraying every conservative principle, and cementing the GOP's reputation as the party of Fox News, Trump sycophants, and angry white nativists. With a raging Trump in office for 2 more years, Democrats have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to realign American politics along progressive lines. Time for our Good Week, Bad Week segment. Seems it was a good week for the birds and the bees. After Pornhub.com introduced a new bee-sexual channel featuring explicit footage of bees pollinating flowers. The site will make donations to a bee conservation charity to help ensure that bees continue to fornicate and pollinate. It was a good week for James Holzhauer, a 34-year-old professional gambler who has won more than $1 million on the TV quiz show Jeopardy. Holzhauer's aggressive betting strategy has him piling up prize money at more than double the pace of show legend Ken Jennings. And it was a good week for Cleveland's Cuyahoga River, which was named America's River of the Year for 2019, 50 years after the then pollution-clogged waterway caught fire and helped inspire the Clean Water Act. The Cuyahoga's turnaround is a national success story, said Bob Irvin, president of American Rivers. But it was a bad week for San Francisco, where a public defecation epidemic connected to its large homeless population is getting worse. The city's recorded number of human feces incidents has increased every year for the past 8 years, from 5,547 in 2011 to 28,084 in 2018. It was a bad week for screens after a new Washington University study found that teens now spend about 8 hours a day and adults 6.5 hours sitting down due to heavy computer use and TV. Everything we found is concerning, said lead researcher Yin Cao. And finally, it was a bad week for blaming the staff after North Korea reportedly executed 4 top officials whom dictator Kim Jong-un faulted for the failure of his second summit with President Trump. The dear leader reportedly also demoted his right-hand man and his sister. And a short piece before we move on, Senate to consider raising smoking age. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said he will introduce a bill later this month to raise the national smoking age from 18 to 21. The minimum age would also apply to purchasing vaping devices, which were used last year by 4.9 million middle school and high school students, according to a recently published Food and Drug Administration survey. Nearly 9 out of 10 cigarette smokers try smoking by age 18. And in McConnell's tobacco-producing state of Kentucky, 34% of cancers are tied directly to smoking. 12 states and 450 localities have already raised the smoking and vaping age to 21. McConnell said he was primarily responding to an unprecedented spike in the number of teenagers who were vaping or smoking e-cigarettes. Our briefing page article this week is titled, Asylum in America. For 150 years, the U.S. has alternated between generously admitting desperate migrants and denying them entry. Has the U.S. always offered asylum? In the country's early history, people fleeing violence and persecution were treated the same as other immigrants. The millions of Europeans who flooded into the U.S. during the 19th century included political refugees and oppressed religious minorities, as well as those seeking better economic opportunities. There were no federal immigration restrictions until the Page Act of 1875 and the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, when Congress banned imported Chinese workers as well as convicted criminals. In the 1920s, lawmakers overwhelmingly passed strict quotas aimed at Catholic and Jewish immigrants from Eastern and Southern European countries. They arrived sick and starving, and therefore less capable of contributing to the American economy and unable to adapt to American culture, said Senator David Reed, Republican from Pennsylvania who co-sponsored the quota legislation. U.S. immigration law, he said, should protect those of us who are interested in keeping America stock up to the highest standard. That is, the people who were born here. Did that stop asylum seekers? The quota system stopped hundreds of thousands of Jews and other Europeans trying to flee Nazi persecution from coming to America. Public opinion remained firmly against admitting more immigrants, even in the face of Nazi atrocities. In a Gallup poll taken 2 weeks after Kristallnacht, a 1938 wave of anti-Jewish pogroms in Germany and Austria, 72% of Americans said the U.S. should not allow a larger number of Jewish exiles from Germany to come to the U.S. In 1939, the U.S. granted visas to just 27,370 people from Germany and Austria, with more than 300,000 people left on a waiting list. That same year, a German ocean liner, the St. Louis, which was carrying 937 mostly Jewish refugees, asked for permission to land in Florida. The Roosevelt administration refused. About a quarter of the ship's passengers would later die in the Holocaust. Why did the laws change? World War II displaced at least 7 million people in Europe. In response, U.S. lawmakers created the nation's first formal refugee and asylum policies. The Displaced Persons Act of 1948 resettled some 400,000 European refugees over 4 years. Meanwhile, the newly formed United Nations recognized the right of refugees to seek asylum in other countries. In 1951, the UN defined a refugee as anyone who cannot return to his or her home country owing to well-founded fear of being persecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership of a particular social group, or political opinion. The U.S. signed on to the UN's Refugee Protocol in 1967, finally creating a comprehensive system for granting asylum with the Refugee Act of 1980 who received asylum, mostly people fleeing communist countries. Since 1975, the U.S. has accepted roughly 3.3 million refugees, the vast majority from Cuba, Vietnam, and the former Soviet Union. Asylum seekers from U.S.-backed right-wing regimes, however, were often rejected as economic migrants. During the 1980s, the U.S. Coast Guard detained 23,000 Haitians fleeing Jean-Claude Duvalier's repressive regime. Of those, only 8 were granted asylum. The same decade, nearly 1 million Central Americans crossed the border fleeing civil wars in the region. Only 3% of asylum applications were approved for Guatemalans and Salvadorans in 1984, compared with 40% for Afghans fleeing the Soviet invasion and 100% for Cuban asylum seekers. This glaring disparity sparked the sanctuary movement, which led Congress creating the Temporary Protected Status Program in 1990 for people affected by armed conflicts or national disasters. Subsequent legislation allowed many Haitian and Central American migrants to apply for permanent residence. How does asylum work? Under U.S. and international law, anyone who physically steps on U.S. soil is entitled to apply for asylum. Asylum seekers must then pass a credible fear interview. If immigration agents determine there is a significant possibility applicants can prove that they face persecution or harm in their home country, their case is referred to immigration court for a final decision. In fiscal year 2018, about 89% of asylum seekers passed the initial screening. But under much stricter rules imposed by the Trump administration, immigration judges went on to grant asylum in only 17% of the cases. What's happening at the border? Central Americans fleeing gang violence, lawlessness, and poverty are claiming asylum, either at official ports of entry or by crossing the border and surrendering to Border Patrol agents. The influx of people who contributed to a backlog of more than 900,000 immigration court cases and overwhelmed detention facilities. Courts have blocked many of the White House's attempts to deter people from seeking asylum in the first place, including separating families and forcing asylum seekers to wait in Mexico for their court date. These people are not openly defying our border, says Mana Yagani, a Houston immigration attorney. The law permits them to seek asylum like any other refugee in the world. Moving into our best columns of the week, we'll start with two from the U.S. If America faces a real threat, there's a stark warning tucked inside the Mueller report. Our government is not ready for a serious crisis, said Yuval Levine. In addition to examining Russian election interference and possible obstruction of justice, the report also provides a disturbing window into how the Trump administration functions. Mueller found that White House officials routinely ignored President Trump's orders because they view him as irrational and ignorant. This has generally served Trump well because his own judgment is often shockingly bad. Indeed, by refusing to fire Mueller or halt the investigation, officials probably saved Trump's presidency. Insubordinate Trump aides have apparently rescued the public from other dark fates. But in the long term, this is unsustainable. In our system of government, the president is supposed to be the final authority. If his aides and cabinet members do not carry out his decisions, the constitutional order breaks down. Who gave these people the power to act for the president? How do we hold them accountable? If we're lucky, we will avoid a national security or economic crisis requiring a functional emergency management response. If not, there is reason to fear that this White House might crumble in an emergency. No escape from surveillance. If you think you are protecting your privacy by being careful about what you disclose online, said Zeynep Tufekci, you're mistaken. The sheer amount of data now available about billions of other people means that opting out isn't really an option. Facebook, Instagram, and other social media companies often ask users if they can access their contacts, which means even if you stay off these apps, the companies can obtain your phone number and email addresses from friends, opening doors to lots of private information. Just by studying your web behavior, the tech giants can now infer a wide range of things about you that you may not ever disclose, including your moods, your political beliefs, your sexual orientation, and your health. Profiles created through web analyses are already being marketed for use in hiring employees, for detecting shoppers' moods, and predicting criminal behavior. The tracking data from your cell phone, which the big phone companies are selling, can reveal that you visited, say, a cancer clinic or the apartment of someone who isn't your spouse. Without regulation, you can expect others to continue to know more and more about you, no matter how discreet you may have been. This comes from Sri Lanka. An Easter massacre of Christians. Sri Lanka was gripped by terror on Easter Sunday, said Kurulu Kujana in the Daily Mirror. In the space of 45 minutes, suicide bombers struck three churches around the country as worshippers were celebrating Mass, and at three upscale hotels in the capital, Colombo, where guests were sitting down to breakfast. At least 321 people were killed and 500 more wounded, and the capital's hospitals were swamped with casualties and corpses. Dozens of foreigners, including at least four Americans, were among the dead. While ISIS claimed responsibility for the slaughter, authorities blamed two little-known local Islamic groups, National Tawhid Jamaat and Jamiatul Millatu Ibrahim, saying they acted with foreign involvement. At least 40 people have been arrested, and investigators said the bombers may have hoped to avenge the recent Christchurch mosque massacres in New Zealand, where 50 Muslims were killed by a white supremacist. In the immediate aftermath of this week's attacks, the Sri Lankan government blocked social media and imposed a curfew, closing all houses of worship. This carnage could have been prevented had officials heeded warnings, said N. Saitha Murthy in Mumbai Mirror from India. Sri Lankans will surely blame the political irresponsibility of the quarrelsome President Maithripala Sirisena and Prime Minister Ranil Wickremesinghe, whose rivalry has paralyzed the government for months. Sirisena was forced to reinstate Wickremesinghe last year after firing him, but then pettily refused to invite him to meetings of the National Security Council. That may be why intelligence alert from the Deputy Inspector General of Police, sent 10 days before the bombings and detailing impending attack on churches and tourist areas, even naming specific terrorists, failed to reach the Prime Minister or his cabinet. Such a lapse is unforgivable, particularly in a country that emerged only a decade ago from a brutal civil war. From 1983 to 2009, the ethnic Sinhalese-dominated government battled the Liberation Tigers of Tamil Eelam, a secular ethnic Tamil separatist group known for suicide bombings. Our government badly mishandled the aftermath of that war, said Ceylon Today from Sri Lanka in an editorial, and we have now paid the price in blood. The reconciliation process, partly driven by the United Nations, involved incarcerating the war heroes and demoralizing the armed forces, all in the name of prosecuting so-called war crimes. Our intelligence services were weakened as a result. The government's incompetency and heedlessness have made this country a haven for extremist terrorists. The Sri Lankan people, though, rose to the occasion, said the Daily News. The country is 70% Buddhist, with the rest Hindu, Christian, and Muslim, and the attacks hit a very multicultural neighborhood where residents of all faiths and ethnicities rushed to help. It was a stirring display of Sri Lanka's social unity and sheer grit in the face of extreme violence and tragedy. Interesting title on our Last Word article this week. It's a question. What's the point of marriage? To get married is to consign yourself to a life of bickering and annoyances, said author and advice columnist Heather Havrileski in New York Magazine. That doesn't mean there aren't good reasons to do it anyway. I recently watched Planet Earth 2 with my family, and the footage of various animals waiting not so patiently for their mates to return to the proper rendezvous point in order to make sweet marital bird love or regurgitate a little fish smoothie into a crying baby throats was enough to send a chill down my spine. This penguin dad is seriously inept at scaling wave-tossed rocks and at locating his lady in a million-strong crowd of other penguin ladies, screeching at the moon together, I found myself thinking. Does her screeching have the faintest hint of burgeoning contempt to it? Or am I just imagining that? Later, as a seabird's baby mama took her sweet time showing up at their appointed meeting spot, I nervously wondered if she'd wandered off with a more dashing seabird and left her endearingly devoted mate in the dust. Okay, he did have a bad habit of nodding and pecking in a faintly insecure, unattractive way. You could see the enormous misunderstandings in play. You do know that I almost got pulverized against the rocks diving for these fish, the harried penguin seemed to say with his beady black eyes once he'd finally arrived. My younger daughter often proclaims that she will never get married, no matter what. And why should she want to? As much as I prefer to believe that her father and I are setting a shiny example of affectionate, radically open communication, the reality is that she's had a lifelong all-access pass to our own version of a penguin marriage. The tedious diplomacy of marital negotiations, the low-key squabbling, the mutual suspensions of disbelief, the subtle undermining, the ever-increasing codependence. After 10 years of this graceless ballet, it's not surprising that all my daughter wants when she grows up is a tiny house, a subcompact car, and a mini Australian Shepherd. And honestly, there are days when the prospect of growing old next to a mini Aussie doesn't sound so bad when compared with the slowly unfolding garden of horrors inherent in aging in sync with another human. To be married is to have the words, "This is all your fault," eternally poised on the tip of your tongue. Marriage can feel like a moral litmus test in this way. Your challenge is to maintain your composure as the staggering deficits of the highly ineffectual human by your side comes into sharper and sharper focus. Somehow you have to keep your sense of humor, which studies suggest is crucial to a healthy marriage. Minimize your contempt, a major predictor of marital dissatisfaction, and increase your joint take-home pay, currently the most accurate predictor of how long a marriage will last, according to some studies. In an upgradable, consumer-driven, instant gratification world where the experiences of shopping for high-end cell phones, high-end mates, and high-end sperm cells are hauntingly similar to one another, isn't it reasonable to question the value of a legal contract written in ink on paper that involves disastrously punitive terms of dissolution? What kind of old-fashioned mutant could crave such a primitive trap, particularly when it's paired with an enormously expensive ceremony that often includes allusions to obedience and lifelong mutual suffering and death of all things? And why do we arbitrarily marry one person instead of, say, 2 or 3 or 15? Doesn't that place an inordinate amount of pressure on a single mate? These days, there are limited economic advantages to marriage. A planet's worth of mates now more easily perused and accessed than ever before in human history, and a host of inconveniences to being married, along with untold drudgery, monotony, frustration, and regret. Add to that the fact that 40 to 50% of all marriages in the United States end in divorce anyway. Considering all that, what could possibly be the point of this outdated charade? My daughter's lack of interest in marriage is not exactly an anomaly. 45% of all Americans 18 and under are now single, and more than half of Americans surveyed said that getting married wasn't an important part of becoming an adult, according to a 2017 Census Bureau report. Moreover, research suggests that single people are more involved in their communities than married people are, exercise more, are generally healthier, and have more friends than married people do. Even the idea that married people live longer than single people do has been thrown into question. It turns out married men live longer than single men, but married women don't live as long as single women. Pro-marriage traditionalists and alt-right pundits love to argue that human marriages were much simpler and more harmonious in the good old days, by which they seem to mean 1950s-style single breadwinner marriages, skimming over the tiny matters of widespread patriarchal enslavement, indentured servitude, domestic violence, the legality of marital rape, and the inability of American women to own property in their own name until at least 1839. But those gold standard marriages actually represent a historical anomaly. As Stephanie Kuntz asserts in her book Marriage, A History, most women and children shared the tasks of breadwinning with men for thousands of years. The notion that love should be the main reason to marry began to take hold only in the late 18th century, according to Kuntz. Before then, as Northwestern University psychology professor Eli Finkel points out in his study of the history of marital satisfaction and success in America, marriage was mostly a matter of survival. Having a spouse helped you harvest the crops and produce more workers to do the same. If Pa brought home a deer and Ma fried up some griddle cakes real nice, and then Pa played the fiddle while Ma cleaned up, what you had right there was a healthy marriage. Pa didn't need to confront his inability to properly tune his fiddle or sing in key, let alone address his recurring tendency to step on the punchline of Ma's jokes when entertaining company. If the dirt floor was swept and the corn was high, all was well. Starting in the mid-1960s, Finkel asserts, married couples began to expect not just emotional sustenance and sexual satisfaction from each other, but also a kind of mutual empowerment. He suggests that this at least partially explains why the divorce rate started to climb around then. High expectations turned good marriages into great marriages, while those uneasy, imperfect pairings began to feel hopelessly inadequate. Whereas marriage was once seen as a joint effort to achieve the good life, these days marriage looks more like a joint attempt to live your best lives, together and separately. Which is a lot. It's hard enough just to live peacefully with someone by your side making noises, emitting smells, undoing what you've just done, interrupting, undercutting, begging to differ. Once you throw in Tinder, internet porn, and our scrolling TL:DR attention spans, marriage seems not just antiquated, but utterly absurd. So why do I love this torturous state of affairs so much? The daily companionship, the shared costs, and the tax breaks are not enough. Maybe I'm the sort of weak bird who would rather wait for her very flawed mate to come home than go out preening and showboating just to wind up with another flawed mate in the end. And yet there's something distinctly reassuring about breaking down, falling into disrepair, losing your charms, and misplacing your keys when you have an equally inept and irritating human tolerating it all, in spite of a million and one very good reasons to put on his walking boots and take his love to town. If marriage is irrational, in other words, as with child rearing and ambition and art, that's also part of its appeal. Even when my husband and I go through a rough time, bickering more than usual over how many tantrums a 12-year-old should throw per day, or how long a particularly fussy loaf of bread should be left to rise, after we've spent a few weeks staring at our phones at night instead of enjoying each other's company, I can always trust that we'll enter an equal and opposite period of humble satisfaction and connection. The other day, in the wake of such a market correction, we began our morning walk with the dogs, who are too neurotic to be walked by one person alone. And my husband announced, "The first thing I thought when I woke up this morning was, you didn't have what it takes. You never did, and you never will." This made us both laugh loudly for a solid block. Marriage can't simply be about living your best lives in sync, because some of the peak moments of a marriage are when you share in your anxieties, your fears, your longing, and even your horrors. That commitment, the one that can withstand and even revel in the darkest corridors of life, grows and evolves and eventually transcends a contract or a ceremony the way an ocean overflows and subsumes a thimble of water. My husband is a good person who makes great bread and has a perfect golf swing. Not that I know or even care what that means. He also wears golf shirts, which are perhaps the least attractive article of clothing available to humankind. I myself am a wise guru type of writer who knows everything about everything, which makes me about as appealing a mate as Jabba the Hutt, if Jabba talked to his dogs more than his children and blamed his hormones every time he fed someone new to the Rancor. We are both catastrophically flawed. But by unearthing our most discouraged moments together, without turning away, by screeching at the moon side by side, admitting this is all our fault, we don't just reaffirm our love, we reaffirm our shared and separate ability to face the unknown from this point forward. That's why sickness and death are key to marriage vows, because there is nothing more divine than being able to say out loud, "Today, I am really, truly at my worst," knowing that it won't make your spouse run for the hills. My husband has seen my worst before. We both know that our worst is likely to get worse from here. Somehow, that feels like grace. This was first published in New York Magazine. On the Health and Science page, we have reviving dead brains with artificial blood. In a landmark experiment that raises profound moral and philosophical questions about the line between life and death, scientists have partially restored cellular activity in the brains of slaughtered pigs. Researchers at Yale University acquired the brains of 32 pigs that had been killed at an abattoir, and 4 hours after they'd been without blood, pumped them with a chemical cocktail intended to slow or reverse the death of brain cells. The brains did not regain anything resembling consciousness. The artificial blood was designed to block nerve signals, but certain brain cells did regain metabolic activity, even responding to drugs, reports the New York Times. When the researchers examined slices of brain tissue, they spotted electrical activity in some neurons. The experiment upends the long-held assumption that the brain dies quickly and irreversibly without oxygen. What we are showing is the process of cell death in a gradual, stepwise process, says study leader Ninad Sestan, and that some of these processes can either be postponed, preserved, or even reversed. Sestan and his team acknowledge that the research raises ethical questions and might change the protocols for organ donation, which rely on a donor being judged brain dead. But the breakthrough could also lead to new treatments to restore function in the brains of patients who have suffered strokes and traumatic brain injuries or are living with diseases like Alzheimer's. The health scare of the week, kids swallowing batteries. The number of young children seen in emergency rooms after swallowing coins, batteries, toys, and other small objects has nearly doubled in 2 decades. Researchers from Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, found that more than 759,000 kids ages 6 and under were brought to ERs from 1995 to 2015 because they'd swallowed something. The average annual rate rose by 92% over that period. There were nearly 43,000 cases in 2015, up from about 22,000 in 1995. Most of the children were 1 to 3 years old, and 10% required hospitalization. The researchers believe the surge in cases is mainly due to the proliferation of electronic devices running on button batteries, reports ABCNews.com. Battery ingestions, the second biggest cause for hospitalizations after coins, increased 150-fold. Button batteries are particularly dangerous if swallowed because they can trigger chemical reactions that cause potentially fatal internal burns. What is of paramount importance is practicing safe storage, said lead author Danielle Orsaj Yentis. If children can't see them, they can't be enticed by them. Microplastics everywhere. Even seemingly pristine wildernesses are littered with plastic pollution. That's the dispiriting conclusion of a new study that found high levels of airborne microplastics in remote areas in the Pyrenees Mountains between France and Spain. Researchers spent 5 months in the region capturing and counting these tiny fragments, less than 1/5 of an inch long, often invisible to the naked eye, that break off larger items such as plastic bags and bottles. They found that an average of 365 microplastic pieces settled on every square meter of land each day. That's comparable to the number of previous study recorded in central Paris. The research shows how far microplastics can be carried by the wind. The nearest city, Toulouse, is about 75 miles away. Humans and other animals ingest microplastics through food and water, but the health effects remain unclear. Lead researcher Steve Allen from the University of Strathclyde in Scotland says the ubiquity of microplastics demands attention. If it is going to be a problem, he tells The Guardian, it is going to be a very big problem. And we're on the Talking Points page now. Time for a couple of articles, I think. We'll start with measles. Could parents be forced to vaccinate? Measles has made a comeback, said Madeline Marshall in Vox.com, and its return has sparked a government crackdown on parents who don't vaccinate their kids. The completely preventable viral disease was declared eradicated in 2000, but in the first few months of 2019, officials have reported 626 cases nationwide, more than in all of 2018. The highly contagious virus can cause fatal complications such as pneumonia and encephalitis, particularly among young children, adults with compromised immune systems, and the elderly. The outbreaks have been mostly confined to small insular communities, including Russian Orthodox-speaking immigrants in Washington State and Orthodox Jews in New York. Since creating herd immunity requires 95% of a population to vaccinate, the outbreaks have pitted the needs of society against the individual liberty of anti-vax parents. That fight is particularly intense in New York City, said Jennings Brown in Gizmodo.com. The city has logged 359 cases, almost all in Brooklyn's Orthodox Jewish neighborhoods. Health officials have ordered compulsory vaccinations in four hard-hit zip codes under the threat of $1,000 fines. Five mothers retaliated by suing the city, arguing that the emergency order violated their religious liberty. But Brooklyn Judge Lawrence Nipple dismissed their case in a strongly worded opinion. A fireman, he noted, need not obtain the informed consent of the owner before extinguishing a house fire. Vaccination is known to extinguish the fire of contagion. This is undoubtedly a sensitive issue, said Elad Hakim in TheFederalist.com. But it appears Nipple's decision is founded on solid legal precedent. The U.S. Supreme Court took up the question of mandatory vaccinations in 1902 amid a smallpox outbreak in Massachusetts. The court ruled in favor of the state, stating, "There are manifold restraints to which each person is necessarily subject for the common good." For Orthodox Jews, this isn't truly a religious issue, said Julia Belutz in Vox.com. Indeed, even most Orthodox rabbis believe vaccinating is a moral duty. But anti-vaccine propagandists, still peddling debunked claims about autism, specifically targeted the Orthodox community because its members live outside the mainstream and are suspicious of modernity and technology. City officials now hope that educating them about the safety of vaccinations, combined with some legal coercion, will change their minds. Sanders, why moderate Democrats are alarmed. From canap-filled fundraisers on the coast to the cloakrooms of Washington, establishment Democrats are freaking out that Bernie Sanders might actually win the party's nomination, said Jonathan Martin in the New York Times. The scenario keeping them up nights is that Sanders, like Donald Trump in 2016, will ride a fanatical base of support through a splintered, historically large field and get a critical mass of delegates. The moderates fear that nominating an avowed socialist would all but ensure that Trump gets a second term. Sanders would send the party's big money donors running for the hills, said James Downey in the Washington Post. Democrats also fear that his nomination would give third-party independent Howard Schultz a reason to get into the race as a spoiler, stealing Democratic votes and putting Trump back in office with less than 50% of the popular vote. The party establishment is even mulling an overt Stop Bernie campaign, said Jim Newell in Slate.com, but that would likely backfire. Sanders would just include that opposition in his anti-establishment messaging. And if mainstream Democrats succeed in damaging him and steering the nomination to someone else, his supporters could become angry, so angry that they'd boycott the general election, as some did in 2016. I'm no Bernie fan, said Steve Chapman in the Chicago Tribune, but would it be so bad if he won the nomination? He's a sure-footed campaigner who nearly pulled off a major upset against Hillary Clinton in 2016. And no one can match his anti-establishment credentials or his forceful advocacy of taxing the rich, attacking inequality, and helping the middle class. He might actually be the Democrats' strongest candidate against Trump. The worst scenario for Democrats is not Sanders winning the nomination, said Andrew Malcolm in the Charlotte Observer. It's the primary vote being so divided that no candidate wins a majority of delegates, leading to a contested convention in July. Because of Sanders' supporters' bitterness over the superdelegates who supported Hillary Clinton in 2016, these party elites don't get to vote in 2020 until the second ballot. But imagine if Bernie's ahead after the first go-round, and then the superdelegates step in to hand the nomination to a more moderate candidate. That would resurrect the left's belief that the nomination was rigged and leave precious little time for healing before the general election. We've got time for a few of the short notes. 55% of teachers say they don't teach climate change in their classroom or talk to their students about it, with almost two-thirds of respondents saying it's outside their subject area. More than 80% of U.S. parents support teaching climate change in schools. More than 1 million Americans have lost health insurance coverage since 2016, according to the Congressional Budget Office. The number of uninsured rose from 27.5 million in 2016 to 28.9 million in 2018. Much of the increase came from people losing Medicaid coverage in Republican-governed states, which under the new Trump administration rules have imposed work requirements that make it harder to qualify for the program. Former White House counsel Donald F. McGahn II was mentioned 157 times in the Mueller report, more than any other witness. Michael Cohen, the president's former lawyer, was cited 136 times. And former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, 87. Immigration was responsible for 48% of the U.S. population growth during the past fiscal year, up from 35% in fiscal year 2011. One in 10 American counties experienced population growth primarily due to immigration. And we'll finish with a quote from Lucille Ball. The secret of staying young is to live honestly, eat slowly, and lie about your age. Well, with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138.